Good evening, everybody. It's a great pleasure to have you all here, and a really great pleasure to have René de Graaf here tonight with his talk entitled The Century That Never Happened. I think it fits perfectly in the frame of our project Wohnungsfrage, the housing question, because the project also questions very much the role of the architect within the realm of housing, or to a larger extent, the role of the architect within the social political realm. And I think we will hear much more about this in terms of that really problematic position that architects take today. Renier joined OMA in 1996 and has been responsible of projects in Europe and the Middle East, including, just to name a few of these projects, the G-Star headquarters in Amsterdam, City Hall in Rotterdam, and the some residential tower in Stockholm. In 2002, he became the director of AMO, which is the, as most of you know, probably is the think tank of OMA. And I think AMO has, over the past few years, developed a very unique approach, somehow situated in this really strange position sometimes between research and practice. And I think it has been highly influential in actually shaping some of the discourses in architecture and beyond architecture, because those projects in a way dealt with architecture in an expanded field. And maybe just to name a few of those projects that you might know also already, for instance, the project The Image of Europe, an exhibition and a project, research project, presenting the history and also the history of the European Union, and to a certain extent also a speculation of what the potential of the European Union might be. Another project was the Energy Report, a global energy plan for 100% renewable energy by 2050, a very ambitious goal, but it's a speculative, yet very practical or pragmatic, to a certain extent, plan, which has been developed over the past 4 years. I will leave it there because we will hear much more about the potential and maybe also the huge contradictions that we can find in architectural practice. Please give a warm welcome to René de Graaf.
Guten Abend. Ich hatte diese ganze Vorlesung auf Deutsch vorbereitet, aber ich verstehe, dass es kein Problem ist, wenn es auf Englisch geht. Ich bin ganz erleichtert, dass das möglich ist, trotzdem. So that's what I will do. I'm not going to talk about any of the projects mentioned in the introduction. That's probably another disclaimer that I that I need to usher right away. So also no contradictions in our work or anything of the sort. Instead, I want to talk about something else. I would like, in a way, to give in lecture form the content of a book that I'm currently working on. The title of the book is The Century That Never Happened, Das Jahrhundert, das niemals stattgefunden hat. And, well, basically the title speaks for itself. It's the double X. It's the 20th century that I'm talking about. And the thing is, when you have a good title for a book, actually the whole reason to finish the book is sort of gone out of the window. Because in a way the title says it all. So the book is an elaboration of this thesis, which I hope to prove. I generally start with this image. This is a man called Franz Reichelt. is an Austrian Frenchman, a tailor, who at the beginning of the century thought he could fly. He had made a special suit, a suit that would serve as a parachute and would allow him to fly. To prove the fact that he could and to show off his invention, he staged jumping off the Eiffel Tower. He had a film crew, professional film crew, filming him as he was very confident that there would be a good result in the end. And so he did. He did fly, only for about 3 seconds, before he dashed onto Earth and died. And I start with this anecdote because, in a way, maybe, just maybe, this anecdote encapsulates the essence of the 20th century, a period of naive optimism which might be doomed to fail. It may take longer than 3 seconds, but to some extent, to what extent can we explain the 20th century as a kind of Himmelbestürmung that was destined to fail? And of course, a lot of signs in the current world tragically indicate that it could. Can a similar story be told about modern architecture? I mean, incidentally, François, this was 1912. That was the same year that Marinetti wrote and published a Futurist Manifesto in Le Figaro, in a way an equal symptom of technological hubris, exaggerated optimism about the powers of technology, erasing previous epochs, etc. But to what extent can we view modern architecture in the same way? This is July 15th, 1972, 3 p.m. In America, when the first block of a social housing project in St. Louis is demolished through dynamite, only 18 years after it had been built in 1956. And it's in a way, an event that is very well known amongst architects. Charles Jenks has written about it. I mean, he has written about the demolition of these blocks in very dramatical terms. Modern architecture died in St. Louis, July 3:32 p.m. or thereabouts, when the infamous Pruitt-Igoe scheme, or rather several of its slab blocks, were given a final coup de grace by dynamite. Now, that is a very interesting thing. This is the bankruptcy of modern architecture, according to an influential critic. Be that as it may, it is interesting to look what happened since. So this is that public housing project in St. Louis at the time of its inception in 1956. That is what is there today. It's a forest. The whole thing is gone. But actually, interestingly, the city around it has gone as well. So it's not only as though the project never happened, it's as though the city around it never happened either. If you look at it today, this is what you see. That's where the project was. That's where the project was. And it's almost like you're looking, this is in the middle of a big American city, and it's almost as if you're looking at a rural condition. If you think away the road, if you think away the cars, it could almost be a 19th century condition. And particularly since this is America, the only real remnant is the church, where one can find consolation about all the things one doesn't have or one doesn't have anymore. Anyway, Jenks's apocalyptic prediction, in a way, has been picked up by other critics. This is Colin Brown, Fred Cutter in Colac City, where they, in a way, take matters a step further. The city of modern architecture has been rendered tragically ridiculous. The city of Hilbersheimer, Le Corbusier, the city celebrated by Siam and advertised by the Athens Charter, the former city of deliverance, is every day found increasingly inadequate. So not only is it the end of modern architecture, the whole ending, or the ending that it is granted by prevailing views, goes a step further. When actually St. Louis, when Pruitt-Igoe was demolished, we didn't only do away with Pruitt-Igoe, we did away with Le Corbusier's Cité Radieuse,
We did away with the Hochhausstadt of Hilbersheimer. We did away with the experiments of the metabolists in Japan. We did away with Louis Kahn in Philadelphia. We did away with the visions of Team 10, which were essentially revisionist visions, even of modernism itself. We did away with Jaap Bakema, which was in a way a Dutch member of Team 10, very prevalent in the Netherlands, gone. And ultimately, we even did away with the kind of tail end afterbirths in the form of avant-garde thinking by things like Super Studio. The collective bankruptcy of 20th century avant-garde thinking concluded as a result of the demolition of a single housing block in America that essentially didn't work. We find ourselves at a very interesting moment in time because, give or take a decade or two, we find ourselves in the context of another end of history, another predicament about time. This is Francis Fukuyama, The End of History and the Last Man, where in a way he claims the recent period is basically the end of the Cold War, not just as the end of a period in history, but the end of history as such, the end of mankind's ideological evolution and the universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government. This book, in a strange way, is an optimistic ending of what you could call an early optimistic ending of the 20th century in the form of thinking that what used to be a world of competing ideologies before 1991, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, was essentially a homogeneous world where, in a way, electoral liberal democracy, it would only be a matter of time before that would be the manifest destiny of the world as a whole. Of course, that has been celebrated quite intensely also as a source of new economic opportunities for Western and Eastern companies alike. And it would be safe to say that also a firm like ours owes its size and partially its business to this assumption. The white dots are basically all our projects at the current moment. When I came in the early 90s, I think we were 35 people, we're just under 400. We work all over the world, partially as a result of this particular period in history. But of course, there's a flip side to everything. What was celebrated, essentially, this is Reagan in front of the wall, I think, calling on Gorbachev to tear it down. But what is celebrated as a very one-sided version of history, of course, had a flip side. This is how they saw it on the other side of the wall, shortly before it was demolished. 50 Jahre antifaschistische Schutzwall. And even though we think that is over, one can really ask, actually, is it over? This is a very beautiful quote from William Faulkner. The past is never dead. In fact, it isn't even past. I think it applies on a scale which probably even Faulkner never even imagined it. Let's look at the map again. So this is, in a way, all our projects in the context of a world presumed to be homogeneous, presumed to be a level playing field of economic opportunities. This is the reality today. This is how we find ourselves. And without necessarily passing judgment on each of the color, I will try to explain them in non-judgmental terms. The blue is where you could say electoral democracy has found ground. There you have elections. The red is non-democracy, which is a nice word, I guess, for dictatorship. There you don't have elections. And the yellow is a very interesting emerging category, which is gaining increasing traction. There you do have elections, but you know in advance who's going to win. It's an increasingly successful simulation of democracy that we find gaining traction not only in former dictatorships as a fig leaf to become respectable, but also as a very tempting form of erosion of established democracies to, in a way, if one can simulate it, why do the real things? Because it's more predictable, etc., etc. So When we thought we would have a similar kind of project everywhere in the world, we find that our projects actually exist in extremely different conditions from which some very interesting lessons can be learned. I'd like to show a few. This is the first. It is a project in the glorious Republic of Kazakhstan. Of course, a former part of the Soviet Union, of course, with all the related legacy of the Soviet Union, both bad and good, here in the form of, you know, ambitious social housing projects, prefabricated housing projects, the Russian version of Plattenbau. But of course, increasingly after the shift of the system, another type of Western thinking gains ground. And of course, it's not generally the most uplifting form of Western culture that gains ground in these areas. This is a nightclub in Almaty. It is very appropriately called Petroleum, because that is where the main source of revenue of Kazakhstan is, I guess. But this is the typical scene you find. Kazakhstan has also recently discovered a love for architecture, as you can see here. It is a form of Dubai light or Dubai extreme, I don't know. But I mean, this is the prevailing consensus of what the architecture of Rishis, or recently found Rishis, is in that part of the world. Of course, we wouldn't be us, if in the context of our arrival, we would spontaneously start celebrating the type of architecture they just did away with. You know, the former constructivist, suprematist exercises conducted in Russia. So we went to work. We were meant to design a science and technology campus, actually, a campus for a privatized university. So this is part of an early experiment of clustering different academic buildings. This is the eventual result. Somewhere in the snow at the front of the mountains, three big clusters for a university campus. So that's what we did. We were very happy. These are our clients. I don't know how much I should say to this image. I mean, I hope it sort of speaks for itself. And of course, as a result of our labor, a very interesting discussion ensued with these clients, essentially sort of impatient. What if you find an even better option tomorrow? Richard is our project leader in this particular case. We don't have time for this talk anymore. Tomorrow we need to present to our options, etc. We cannot just say Oma told it's better, and then the conversation continues. Richard, I've got marked copies which you gave me proving the evidence of agreement. It's strange to see your resistance. I will report the issue to Yermak. So this sounds like a 1 a.m. Knock on the door in the morning. But it was very clear that, to some extent, that level playing field, or at least an intellectual level playing field in the world at large, is nowhere near there. So that was the end of that. But there was another chance. This is a Naukograd, as they call it in Russia, a science city. In 2010, the Russian oligarch Viktor Vekselberg, at the directive of the Kremlin, was commissioned to, in a way, build such a Naukograd, which they interpreted as a top-down Silicon Valley, basically a Silicon Valley on the outskirts of Moscow at the directives of Moscow. Here we went to work, produced another similar plan with a very strong modernist aesthetic, in a way taking further also some of the formal experiments which had been present in let's say, communist and Soviet architecture. That looked like it was going well for a while. Russia wants an article by Aaron Betsky in an internet journal. We were asked to, and actually commissioned to, elaborate parts of it to a very great degree. We held presentation in the highest of circles. This was the then president, Medvedev. But clearly here also the past isn't dead and buried. In fact, it isn't even past. So in a way, The likelihood of this scenario, I guess, meant a sort of agree to disagree, and that was that either. I'd like to go on. And this will be more than just the chain of disasters, I promise. Much of the red, and much of the yellow, but particularly much of the red, is actually the part of the world where today also the most rapid growth of cities takes place. That means that rapid city growth takes place in conditions which are totally antithetical to any of the planning lessons we have been learning about democratic procedures, procedural correctness. They just grow almost out of the blue. This is Dubai in 1990. Sheikh Zayed wrote, the center of Dubai. And this is that same road 25 years later. You don't see the road anymore. It's essentially a big sort of downtown. Interestingly, nothing in this picture is older than 20 years. Nevertheless, there is a city there, and the end is not in sight. In a way, the city itself is also the host of an almost permanent real estate fair of ever bigger, ever more extravagant, ever more warped, ever more whatever type of buildings. But the interesting thing there is that the sheer pace creates a very interesting ambiguity. You probably all know this man, Santiago Calatrava, a very well-known Spanish architect with his turning skyscraper, the Turning Torso, built in Sweden. This is some random building at the Dubai Real Estate Fair, and it's probably built for half the budget, in half the time, with half the hassle, with no prima donna nagging about details, etc. And it's there. And it's amazing how a place like that has an incredible confidence that it oozes. This is a slogan we found on one of the stands in that same fair. One day, all cities will be built like this. And then all cities will look like this. Now, this is a skyline composed of all the buildings we found in that real estate fair. They're all built by either architects you don't know, or not by architects at all, just basically property developers or engineers with a kind of few architects employed on the side to give shape to their building procedures. But the cumulative result of that labor, of the labor of all the people no one's ever heard of, is this. This is that same skyline, actually composed of buildings known by architects that are very well known, by Pritzker Prize winners, by the stars who are celebrated of international architects. And I know it's probably a very slippery slope for me to talk about this, but I still want to ask the question. We have this, and we have this. And is there really such a difference? I mean, is the sum total of genius and the sum total of supposed artistic whatever, is it really so different from the efforts that are just par defaut? And in the middle there is our building. That was our most iconic building that we'd ever done for the Chinese state television, completed in 2008. But you almost need to circle it with a line to pick it out of this skyline, because in a way, apparently, the cumulative result of each building trying to be extravagant is monotony, is anonymity. And that is a very, very strange paradox. So this was, I think, 2008, 2009 that we were working here. And the crisis came, which in a way we at least not so much thought of as a blessing in disguise, but at least a welcome pause to reconsider what essentially was also quite a disconcerting realization for ourselves. So there you go. Boom. Gone. That death of that skyline was in a way the weird moment also of a rediscovery. This was a building we did in the middle of it all. A building partially housing, partially a hotel, partially offices. A new formal experiment, we called it. A very varied, very rich form, a massive presence from one side, exceptional slenderness from another side, only to reveal massive presence. when you travel on, a facade which in a way partially emphasized the redundancy, with a few exceptions, I guess, as our pockets of resistance towards ultimate boredom. But interestingly enough, this building, although it's an autonomous single shape and it's a perfect prismatic shape, is an extremely contextual building in the sense that it lives off its context, where its context is this, this building thus that. And the weird irony is that in a context where everybody is extravagant, where extravagance has become the norm, the boring becomes the extravagant. The boring becomes absolutely exciting once more. So this was a competition. We didn't win this competition. I don't know whether that was intentional or not, or whether this was the same suicide mission as Franz Reichelt attempted at the beginning of this lecture. But nevertheless, we were very happy. We sort of branded this whole reproach as a new, fresh celebration of the generic, which, you know, amidst the formal extravagance of many of our colleagues, seemed original, etc., etc. Don't know where it gets us, but quite interestingly, it wasn't built, but we discovered it years later somewhere else, almost by accident. This is a bit of a jump, but this is the Holiday Inn in Beirut, and I basically am using this because I slowly want to get to another point. This is the Holiday Inn in Beirut. It is a hotel, but it was a hotel. It's a hotel full of bullet holes. It's a monument in the middle of the city, because in the Civil War in Beirut, it was fought over room by room, and it was a battlefield which, you know, once conquered, would allow the warring faction to control the city. It was, every room was fought over day to day, and it took months before one group, so here you see a Palestinian freedom fighter in front of a photograph of Nasser, finally took control of the building and finally established somehow that the battle turned in such a way that it was finally won by the party that has won. And that building stands in the middle of Beirut. The city has moved on. The city has entered the 21st century with the same amount of energy that many other places have entered the 21st century. Many property developers and many other attempts have been made to revitalize this building, to turn it into a hotel again, turn it into something else again, but all have mysteriously failed. So that building represents probably 100,000 empty square meters in the middle of the city that nobody knows what to do with, but nevertheless is very, very present. Buildings of a similar size go up everywhere, new. Nobody knows what to do with this building. This gets built across the road. It's a residential project by Herzog and Demeron. And it stands straight, it's about the same size, and it stands strangely adjacent to the building nobody wants and nobody knows what to do with. It's a full building. I think all the apartments are sold, stands opposite the empty building. And for me, this was a very strange moment. You know, we have modern architecture, and we have modern architecture. We have modern architecture of the 20th century, we have modern architecture of the 20th century, and then a kind of strange difference started to emerge, which in a way is almost irrespective of stylistic differences, that apparently some of the same language can serve a very different purpose in a very different time of history. This is how that the Herzog and Demeron building is the Beirut Terraces is being received, a world-class icon. There's many these days. But this is another aspect of it. It in a way constitutes a price range of the apartments that is such that it in a way helps the upward pressure of housing prices to the point, to the point that in a way the asking price for these apartments is pushing out a lot of the traditional residents of Beirut. It, in a way, solves problems not by bringing people together. It simply solves problems by gentrifying the whole center, which by definition means that any cultural clash isn't solved. It's simply eradicated. So if modern architecture once had a social mission, it seems to be increasingly contributing to an anti-social mission. And this is happening everywhere. I mean, this is the Beirut terraces in Beirut, a similar project of them in New York, another gentrified center, a different architect, but doing the same thing partially in China. And this in parts and parcel explains a current mood of resistance. I think the utterances of this man have often been misunderstood, but I think they can best be explained as a last attempt, you know, to protect a state, a nation, a people from the imminent takeover of capital, which now manifests itself also in the form of modern architecture. There was such a very, very interesting echo. What is it? The architecture should be like the sunshine from the blue sky and the breeze in spring that will inspire minds, warm hearts, cultivate tastes, and clean up undesirable work styles. I guess, I mean, the last few words are the essence. But this is a very weird echo because this is 1954, the secret speech of Nikita Khrushchev. And all this is called architectural and artistic decoration of buildings. No, comrades. This is architectural perversion that leads to the spoiling of materials and to unnecessary expenditure of resources. It's much the same thing. You know, more than half a century later, it is much the same thing, a calibrating of architecture to somehow the notion of a social task. And in that sense, you can make a number of comparisons and really wonder. This is Golosov Workers' Club, I think from 1928 in Moscow. This is its 21st century equivalent. This is Zaha Hadid's Contemporary Art Museum in Cincinnati. This is the Wolkenbügel by Eleschitzky. This is its equivalent in Rotterdam. No comment. This is the Unité d'Habitation. You all know it very well. This is Richard Meyer. No comment again. This is House 20 by Rietveld. This is House 6 by Peter Eisenman. It's the same, but something feels wrong and something feels different. But it's what exactly is different? This is the Barcelona Pavilion by Mies van der Rohe. This is a bus stop by OMA in Groningen. So I really didn't want to exempt ourselves from the ridicule. So there you go. But in the most common terms, what happened? This is the Maison Domino, the Domino diagram, which introduced the plan libre, the facade libre, the whole liberation and grammar that modern architecture is based on. This is 1914. It coincides with the beginning of the First World War. And this has been built many, many times. I mean, we see it all over the place still, you know, more than a century later. Only this time, it no longer symbolizes the hope and the liberation of architecture. It's no longer the beginning, you know, of a roaming freedom in architecture. It's now come to symbolize the bankruptcy of real estate. Here, this is taken from an advert in Greece. It's deliberately not finished, because if you don't finish a building, it gives you a very important tax break. So the hope of the beginning of the 20th century has become, in a way, the hope for a tax break at the outset. And I really think that there a major difference is occurring, that somehow pending on the economic circumstances and pending on the system within which architecture operates, the same grammar, the same repertoire can serve completely different aims. It can be the source of a very uplifting modus in one system. It can be the source of a completely malign, malignant development in the other. This is a recent book by Thomas Piketty, French economist, which in a way analyzes the 20th century in economic terms, well, analyzes history in economic terms. And there is a very interesting synergy between the trend he discovers in economics and the history of modern architecture. I will try to explain. French economist, in a way, what he does in his book is a very simple comparison. He compares, over the course of history, the returns on labor vis-a-vis the returns on capital. In very simple terms, how much money do you make from working and how much money do you make from money? How much money do you make from having? How much money do you make from working? And as soon as you make more money by having money, of course, inequality rises. I mean, you can work all you want. Those who have will always accumulate faster than those who acquire by working. So the beauty of his book is that he's compared the two over a very, very long period of history and found that, in essence, only in the 20th century, for a brief moment in history, were the returns on labor higher than the returns on capital. That is the particular period, roughly, you know, from the beginning of the century till before the turn of the next century. Now, if we compare all the previous utopias and idealist utopian projects that I crossed out at the beginning of the lecture, and we compare them in time, we see that they neatly, for most part, conform to this period. That these periods were the expression of hope in a period where actually you can change class by working, a period of social mobility, because I mean by working you can catch up with those who are rich, by people who become rich, who change their fate, that to some extent you could reinterpret the more idealistic part of modern architecture as social mobility cast in concrete. This particular episode, described by Charles Jenks, Pruitt-Igoe development, happens in 1972. That shakes, of course, the confidence of the profession. The profession doesn't become inactive, however. It continues its idealistic vein. However, it continues it now mostly in the form of books, in the form of case studies, and less in the form of implemented blueprints. So there you are. And interestingly enough, you see, if you zoom out again, that utopian thinking, that type of particular utopian thinking, is reserved for the exact same period that Piketty identifies as a period of social mobility through labor. Now, this is very interesting. It runs roughly from 1914 till 1989. It runs roughly from the shot in Sarajevo, the outbreak of World War I, to the fall of the Berlin Wall. This was the most important modernist manifesto written at the beginning of that period. It's actually 1912, but for argument's sake, I've made it 1914. It's the Futurist Manifesto. It's very interesting to guess what might be the most important architectural manifesto of 1989. We found it to be this: a vision of Britain by Prince Charles, a largely reactionary, nostalgic document for everything that had preceded modernism, and a basic dismissal of modernism as an anomaly. So it's very interesting. From the bloody uniform of Franz Ferdinand of the Austro-Hungarian Empire to the decorated uniform of the Prince of Wales, it is as though this period simply was never there. It is though as if we simply, after 1989, can carry on where we left off in 1914. We can glue the diagrams together. Both men had a passion for hunting, and both men had a passion for architecture. There's the Belvedere in Vienna and Buckingham Palace, seemingly a single thing. And if you think this is an exaggeration, which of course it is, I would still urge everyone to think twice, because this is This is a number of things that have happened since 1989. This is a social housing project in France, Cité de Balzac, 1960, demolished in 2012. Aylesbury, London, Trenton, 1963, another big social housing project. It died in 2010. Bellefontaine, Candlelist, Josick and Woods, other Team 10 architects, colleagues of the Smiths and Zambakama, in 1964, demolished in 2011. I can go on the red row flats in Glasgow, St. Bunton, 1964, demolished in 2014. This is a Dutch example, the Bijlmer Meer, first the scene of a plane crash in 1992, but then its fate was definitively sealed in 2009, when actually much of the 11-story blocks were reduced to two- or three-story blocks, and it was inherently turned into a suburb. But Dundee, 1967, gone in 2013. I can fill a whole evening with all of this. Vela di Scampa, Naples, Franz di Salvo, 1975, a much more recent example, again demolished in 2008, you know, some 30 years later. This is another example, but this wasn't demolished. What happened here was that it wasn't demolished, but was privatized, and in a way that amounts to exactly the same thing. It was privatized. It had a lot of small social rent apartments when it was built in 1972. Those are now sold. And this is a little survey of the finances that go together with that. The annual gross income in the United Kingdom is roughly £32,000 a year. You can borrow about four to five times that. So that means the maximum mortgage on that income is capped at £152,000. And of course, a one-bedroom flat is £333,000. So more than double the maximum mortgage that any, not even low earner, but any average earner can acquire. So it's very interesting that in a way the apartments, which were meant for the masses, for everybody, in a way, the existence minimum meant for the masses becomes the existence minimum of the 20th century becomes a privileged condition in the 21st. You know, which is about the same as taking the building down, because I mean, when you take it down, it becomes unattainable. When you make it too expensive, it becomes unattainable. And it seems that something that was within grasp, you know, housing people in an affordable manner in modern architecture, is totally out of reach 30 years later. I have another example, probably a little more well-known in the context here. It's about Marzahn, East Berlin. After the fall of the wall, part of the city that clearly is dealing with a very big demographic decline, a decline in population, partially a leaving population, aging population that results in empty schools, that results in the demolition of empty schools. What else can you do with them? The partial demolition of a lot of prefabricated housing, which of course exists in abundance in the former DDR. But even a kind of protest emerging against the demolition of that whole thing. It's interesting when you look back in history. Of course, in the 70s, Berlin Mitte was largely overcrowded and had very bad living conditions still 30 years after the war. And Marzahn, as a little village to the east, was designated as the home of a new town. This was shortly after its inception. It is a very interesting combination of a horse and a carriage and a small village with kind of Plattenbauten emerging in abundance immediately behind. But be that as it may, for a while, much throughout the 80s, it was a regular living quarter, here with a regular scene, and even to some extent a sort of vibrant living quarter here to the east of Berlin. A very vibrant living quarter indeed. This last picture actually isn't Marzahn, it's Gropiusstadt. It's not East Berlin, it is West Berlin. But it looks suspiciously similar to the way East Berlin looked before the wall was taken down. It is for me actually surprising. This is East Berlin and this is West Berlin, both taken somewhere, photographs taken somewhere in the mid-80s. And it is a very strange phenomena for me still that although both halves of the city and both halves of the country were governed by extremely different, say, opposing political ideologies, that the similarity in physical manifestation was there, that they were so similar, even though politically they were so different. And of course, what you see as a case study is that ever since the fall of the wall with the unified Germany, with Germany governed by one government, one system, one ideology, becomes the home of, one could say, larger physical differences than they were when they were governed by two systems. This was a thing, demographics, East Germany increasingly empty, West Germany increasingly full. That's probably all being exacerbated as we speak. Disposable income, a massive difference. Unemployment rate, a massive difference in the other direction. Foreigners, again, a massive difference. And, of course, racism, a very massive difference in the other direction. Inversely proportional to the actual amount of foreigners, interestingly enough. And that's a trend, if you watch the news, we see in Europe as a whole at the moment. No comment. But the strange thing is, and it's not a bitch about Germany anyway, the strange thing is we took down this wall. That's a wall. That was a wall between two opposing ideologies, where one could say the other, maybe they kept each other in check. Maybe the simultaneous existence of two systems, in a way, enforced decent behavior on either side of the system. But while we took down this wall, we are building, or somebody's proposing to build, a very big wall, in as much as it doesn't already exist here. The U.S. and Mexico walls appear. I think this is Brazil. I think this is Caracas. But anyway, we took down the wall, which divided two systems in the whole world, only 30 years later, to see a proliferation of walls throughout the world. If the wall was a single wall, the wall is now a global phenomena. I mean, globalization seems to lead to the global presence of walls. And it is a very serious question where all of this is going. So in 1914, 1989, we had utopian fantasies. Before it, we had feudalism. What will we have next? This is, again, a drastic simplification. I apologize. But in the rhetorical context, I guess it makes sense. I want to go back to Fukuyama. You know, the pre-1999 situation in a way has resulted in a similar situation, although of different systems, different views, and a world that for sure isn't one, although the ideological differences are never made explicit anymore. And that is the danger, that this is a world we presume is one, but it's no more one than this world was. And it's in part a world that is increasingly embraced, particularly the yellow category of the pseudo-democracy enjoys immense popularity in the profession of architects. This is an interesting quote from Norman Foster. China rather than England. In Beijing, they've built a much larger new terminal than Terminal 5, plus a new runway to serve it, etc., etc. He essentially complains about the incredible slow procedures of democracy, and in the process of that, in a way, glorifies China, which, of course, I guess for an architect, if you want to have a fast-track schedule and a related fee, makes sense, but it goes with... It's a step too far to, in a way, generalize that, but it is being generalized, as we can see here. We're in a state of denial while they, the Chinese, are making decisions in the spirits of the Victorians. They have the courage to try it. I don't know who this is. What attracts me about China is that there's still a state, there's still something that can take initiative on the scale and nature of almost nobody we know could ever afford or contemplate. Eisenman, the more centralized the power, the less compromise need to be made in architecture, the directions are clearer. Democracy, obviously, isn't something we want to give up, but it does create chaos. This is Frank Gehry, by the way. It means the guy next door can do whatever he wants. It creates a collision of thinking. In cities, people build whatever they want. Some of the most amazing places were built because of dictators. Architecture is always related to power and related to large interests, whether financial or political. Bernard Tschumi, and I think this one is priceless. It sums it up all. I think the best thing to have is a benevolent dictator with taste. So, one wonders. I mean, these are all individual architects. They are in competition with each other, but in one respect, they seem to enjoy a remarkable amount of consensus. And I ask, what is that consensus? Because it's a similar consensus as the consensus presumed by Fukuyama. I mean, the whole quote is true, apparently, in the context of this profession, with the exception of three words. And that's Western liberal democracy. Because we may see the end of history. We may see the end of mankind's ideological influence. We may see a universalization across the world of all of it. But I doubt very much whether it will be blue. It might actually be the yellow. And that is a question if that will still amount to a yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Renier, for this. It's difficult to actually frame it into words what we were just witnessing. I think it's quite an intriguing presentation of where architects are actually working, the kind of context that has very particular political and economic dimension, and as you made clear, the utopian or social political dimension is something that doesn't seem to be there anymore today. What you described as a century that didn't happen, and that's more absent than ever right now. How would you maybe frame what, because there was a big question mark about today or the next few years. What's necessary to do? Because I know that the book you mentioned that's referring to your presentation right now, it takes also the somehow as a reference point, Thomas Piketty, and I think the little graph was quite intriguing in a way, describing what's happening today and where we work as architects. What's necessary? How can we work? Actually, how can we continue?
Yeah, this is of course the question
it's
that generally.
Of course, also a very dark picture that we.
No, but this is, of course, the question that ensues generally when I hold this talk. And the answer is, I don't know. But I think, you know, that the solution to any problem starts with the frank acknowledgement that there is a problem. And inasmuch as this talk attempts to do anything, it attempts to do that. I have often thought, I mean, it is, for me, quite amazing how architects and architectural education can be so oblivious of its context and can be so oblivious of the way the world operates at large and can still take pride because they make 90-degree angles, or wide forms, or in a way deploy the whole language of modernism, when the actual economic context means that that language is being deployed for completely opposite motives. And I've always thought that it might make sense to introduce a pause in maybe stylistic production, in education, to simply take stock of the context again in order to define a program, because I simply refuse to think that many of the earlier heroes were as oblivious to context as contemporary architects. So in that sense, this is a modest contribution to that.
But in a way, I think it's interesting. One of your, to me, most striking issues was actually the relation between the grammar and the context. And to a certain extent, these parallel lines in relation to Piketty showed also that there was a new grammar developed in a time where you had all the possibilities described by Piketty on a social political level. So it seems as also the grammar is, or it's not only a political circumstance that might be a problem, but is it also the grammar?
You mean architectural grammar?
Yeah, whatever the grammar is. I think for me it's difficult to grasp actually what the grammar is, but I think you're hinting at architectural grammar.
Yeah, well, not per se. I mean, I think architectural grammar is often related to technological inventions. I don't think the Maison Domino would have existed without the possibilities of reinforced concrete. The skyscraper wouldn't have existed without steel and the invention of the elevator, etc., etc. And I think another thing, because of course I'm constructing an analogy, and I'm sure there is more than just this analogy, but the analogy is very tempting and makes something very clear. But I think we also live in a time where the most radical inventions of today have a limited impact on form. I don't think the whole, and I know there's a lot of discussion about smart cities, about smart buildings and blah, blah, blah. But I simply don't think that the digital, because that's what it is, ultimately, has the same repercussions on form as reinforced concrete had. It doesn't. I think it's quite the opposite. I think the digital permits us to use anything in any fashion, simply because there is an enhanced knowledge about processes. So I don't think it's an impetus for architectural grammar at all. And I think that is another dilemma where we find ourselves, that we may also have exhausted a certain amount of physical revolutions.
It's probably the opportunity to directly open to the floor. I think, Reinhold, you have a question.
Yeah, just a quick one from one of the earlier heroes, 1923. So architecture or revolution? Which one?
I don't know. I mean, is that up to me to answer? I think that's always, I mean, that is an interesting Corbusier quote. And I think that that quote has been often misunderstood, because, I mean, people, you can explain that quote very interestingly in two ways. You can say, provide the peoples with homes, or otherwise they will revolt. I think that's only partially what he meant. I think he partially hinted as architecture as revolution, that in a way he was hinting at the stylistic revolution that his architecture embodied. Because, I mean, Corbusier, of course, of all architects, was a huge ideological promiscuous figure, who worked for the Vichy regime and who worked for Stalin on both sides of the fence. But I don't think it's an either-or. I think he clearly intended one to be manifested through the other. And I think partially, although that seems very outmoded historical thinking, I think contemporary architecture could do with a bit of that.
we'll talk later. But to explain a little bit, so the first answer was the Rosa Luxemburg. What you answered was the question, reform a revolution first. Mm-hmm. In other words, provide housing or whatever, and so that people don't revolt. But then you, at the other end of the arc, the narrative arc of your talk, which began with the New York Times bestseller sticker on your book, and then Fukuyama, which actually was a New York Times bestseller over there. If you were to have said yes to that question, yes, yen, euro, dollar, which Fukuyama obviously did, your book would not likely or will not likely be a bestseller if you had answered revolution. So that's the context in which I wanted to ask that question.
But I'm not sure I understand.
Well, because in other words, Fukuyama's is a political proposal. As you pointed out, but it's also an economic one. Western liberal democracy and capitalism. At the time that Le Corbusier was kind of working, and I think you're kind of tapping into this moment, it was still in some sense up in the air, one could say. And so one could say that in that regard he felt the need to answer the question, because Rosa Luxemburg and many others had posed similar questions before. At this point, it seems possibly, and the kind of work of people like Fukuyama, even Piketty, who does not pose that question, he's not that kind of economist, would do another kind of work. In other words, they do a kind of discursive, a kind of meta-discursive work that foreclosed the possibility of that kind of question being answered politically. Mm-hmm. Do you see that? Do you see what I'm saying? So that's why I'm not asking you to kind of, raise a flag one way or the other, but I am trying to point
it's clear that, of course, there was a debate, and there was the simultaneous existence of two ideologies. And I think it's interesting that, if it's architectural revolution, and in other words, if you take it very literal, let's say you provide the people with architecture so they don't revolt, then that in a way is evidence of the threat of one system, revolution, invading the other system, which enforces good behavior on the other side of the fence. I mean, the whole argument and context that Fukuyama and Piketty work in, of course, it is in the context of a lack of an alternative, where capitalism, when it roams free, escalates a certain outcome, and it appears to be, if you take Piketty's conclusion, it escalates an outcome very much in the wrong direction. So in that sense, the need for a new revolution against that unwarranted escalation is very, very clear, although it is very hard at this day and age to pin your hopes on any political system to take care of that, because they all benefit from it in different ways. And the only thing they do differently is, in a way, is the procedures they organize around democracy, which is meaningless anyway, because with ever larger amounts of money being privatized, the amount of public money people vote about becomes more marginal and marginal anyway, whether it's blue, red, or yellow. So in that sense, I wouldn't even dare, because a revolution presumes a certain amount of solidarity that you can mobilize in people to actually revolve. And I basically, at this point, wouldn't know where to begin. But I think, a certain amount of desperation can make for a bestseller as well. I mean, as much as overly optimistic portrayals of the future. Anyway, it was a joke, to be absolutely clear.
More questions? Somewhere?
Yeah. Hi there, Stephen Malloy is my name. I'm wondering, is what you're really mourning the decline of totalitarianism? I mean, the golden age that you draw out for us with these utopias you select coincides with the totalitarian governmental form that happens to not be feudalism. And then you have this one picture of the Berlin Wall where you asked us the questions, did each side keep the other in check? You don't seem to mourn the decline of free market capitalism, which one might say, because one might also say that outside of the big cities, that people just built, as they have been building, in the last few hundred years. You know, if you look at the homes that most people live in the free world, they were in no way radical, in no way formally interesting. They're kind of iterations of a vernacular. Whereas in a totalitarian system, you can enforce a formal language on the population, and you do so for the purposes of mobilizing sentiment and mobilizing propaganda. Mm. And now that that's been taken away from us, people are just going to stumble on with iterations of the vernacular. Is that what you're mourning?
Is that what I'm mourning? Well, what I think is strange, because, I mean, that debate, what you are currently signaling, coincides with the most rapid urbanization in human history. That coincides where, you know, currently 50% of people live in cities, before too long 70% of people live in cities, and where, to some extent, the presumed form of existence is actually modern. I mean, people live, when they live in 20th century or 21st century cities, they live in the modern condition. And it remains to be seen whether you can live in that modern condition with the same vernacular types that you're describing, and whether that isn't the kind of a crash in the making.
Well, would you say Los Angeles is not modern?
I would say Los Angeles is very modern. And it depends, of course, what you could call modern, because, I mean, the most modern thing in this day and age is the rejection of modernism. And modernism is actually old-fashioned, because it's part of the century that never happened. Whether this is ultimately a benign... It's a very strange thing. Whether this is ultimately a benign thing, I don't know. I mean, the free market is modern. The 21st century is modern. But it's entangled in a very weird embrace of 19th century phenomena.
Do we in this room just have to accept that modernism was a style that existed parallel to a huge amount of other styles that never went away and were, statistically speaking, more successful all along?
No, I'm certainly not prepared to accept it, because I think once you define modernism as a style, it ceases to be modern. I mean, once you define modernism as a style, and that was, of course, done in the history of modernism very early on, that in a way you separate the style from the ideological premise in order to make it one of many, and therefore to, in a way, dismember any ideological power that goes with it. I mean, I think a certain form of radical politics presuppose a certain form of relative stylistic unity. So in that sense, you are absolutely right that it's geared to a form of top-down. And I would be the first to say that, you know, utopian thinking has shown its dangers throughout history. There's abundant evidence of it. I think we're currently entering a period where we are only beginning to know the dangers of an absence of utopian thinking. And my question, and that is the crux of this, is that danger not equally as big, if not bigger?
I think we are having another question here.
I would like to... this is Saitari Kötner.
Where are you? Sorry.
Hi, Saitali Kötner from Istanbul. I would like to know your thoughts about this. I mean, in your formula, or your formula underlying your ideas.
I wasn't aware there was any formula.
I mean, yeah, your speculative way of thinking. There's no climate change in the formula. If you add it into your thinking, I would like to know more about your idea. I mean, thoughts about this climate change, possible sixth extinction in near, I don't know. It's not there in...
Well, I'll do that next time.
Because you thought...
I mean, there's only so much you can cram into 45 minutes before boring everyone to death. But why do you specifically bring it up in the context of what I've just told? I mean...
You are speculating about it, instead of becoming blue, the world becoming yellow.
Yeah, it becomes blue as in terms of water. Yeah.
I mean, in a political way. Mm-hmm. This climate change issue is, if we add it to the, you know, way of our thinking, maybe we can think about what the future will bring next. You know, this it is related with that question mark. That's why a new variable in the storyline.
Maybe to answer your question in a more serious way, and maybe we don't have to wait till next time. It's interesting. We've done a number of projects. You mentioned them very kindly in your introduction about Europe. Commissioned by the European Union to, in a way, study the case and the cause of that whole transpolitical phenomena. One was political, and the other project was done in the context of energy provision. And it was very interesting that where the political project never managed to articulate a real case for that transpolitical system, the energy project did. I mean, in the context of something as pragmatic as energy provision, the benefits of European cooperation became abundantly clear. And that was very nice because energy is essentially politically not as charged. It's uncontroversial. We all need it. And in that sense, you know, you can argue, you know, that what little is left of international institutions like the League of Nations, like the UN, which are also all 20th century phenomena that are also looking like they never happened at times, that actually a lot of that thinking can get a new impetus from a very pragmatic existential reason for transnational collaboration. And maybe that is the revolution that awaits around the corner, but I don't know.
Just Lihu.
Thank you very much for the lecture. It was, for most part, it's very inspiring. Although I think it's a pity that somehow it ends as if it's unfinished. But I can sense your still believing utopia or idealism, which I hope. Because, you know, OMA's office I respect very much. But my question today is that how do you see your own operation of today as an office, where you expanded from 35 people to hundreds of people, right?
Yeah. So, well, first about not finishing the lecture. I mean, the topic that I broach is essentially so megalomaniac that finishing the lecture in that context would be presumptuous.
There seems to be some kind of underline that.
So. You know, so it's mainly, I mean, I have tried with the lecture to ask particular questions, which I also said in response to the gentleman's question. How do I see our own work?
Your operation, for instance, you know, we talk about the great utopia ideas back in the 20th century. You know, those were done with a singular vision, a small operation in terms of the office. But now when you have office working many places in the world, how do you see, I mean, how do you see a way, I mean, put a simple way, to control a consistent ideology or approach, idealism, or put in a simple way, a quality?
That is a very interesting question because it's of course, operating in the context of the market economy means that you are consistently working for different clients with a manifestly partial interest, their own. Nevertheless, as an architect, you are expected to leave a coherent body of work through actually something that relies on shifting loyalties or you go out of your business. So in that sense, a kind of preemptive stylistic or ideological coherence formulated in advance in that context where you have to survive as a business is very problematic. And I don't know, because, I mean, I think if I think of our day-to-day business, if I think of our Monday mornings in the office, it is not that coherence doesn't matter. It is not that legacy doesn't matter. It is not, but it's almost done via a judgment call, via, first of all, the cultivating of an extreme independence vis-a-vis clients or political systems. So then at least the coherence is in the fact that you make the judgment calls, but it's almost done on a case-by-case basis. And it's often done without clients being too overtly aware that their own limited mission is actually part of a larger mission, and maybe this will be realized at some point. But you almost do it more by stealth than through manifesto. I mean, that is very much a result of operating in the current condition. And also, in parts, we are complicit, like Herzog and Demeron, and like some of the examples I show. I would not exempt ourselves from the trend I signaled. I mean, I very aggressively could also present this whole lecture as a form of introspection just to ourselves. So I also don't want to set ourselves necessarily apart from colleagues.
I was just thinking, how would Thomas Piketty run an architectural office?
I have no idea. He'd probably pay a lot of tax.
Yeah, probably. Are there more questions? I don't think so. So we thank you so much for this.
We're going on to
this.
Tomato soup.
Exactly. Yeah. So we will discuss much more, I'm sure, over food and drinks. Thank you so much for this really inspiring lecture. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah? Thank you.